Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher, and my guest today is the recently former Congressman Richard Hanna. For three terms, he represented New York's 22nd District, which includes all of Shenango, Cortland, Madison, and Oneida counties, and parts of Broome, Herkimer, Oswego, and Tioga counties. Known as a moderate Republican, Congressman Hanna retired at the end of 2016. Congressman, Richard, I guess, welcome back
to the program.
No,
thank you.
Let me start with a question about your successor, Claudia Tenney. You had some bitter campaign battles with her in 2014, and you did not endorse her in 2016. So do you have any thoughts about how she's doing so far in this position?
Well, you know, you build a body of work over time, but she's been true to her roots in terms of her being an extreme far-right person, you know, anti-LGBT, anti-woman's choice, anti-environment, certainly supported Paul Ryan in the health care bill, which is something I could not have done. So she is working to the base that elected her, and they can decide on their own. I'm sure there are a great many people very happy with that. Knowing the district as I do, I would say that a greater many people, many more people are not happy with that. I'm not.
How did the transition in terms of thinking about constituency service and the sort of logistics? How'd that go between the two offices?
Good and bad. We spent a lot of time organizing. You have to get permission from people to – written permission to forward their casework, IRS, Veterans, Social Security. In my time, I handled – our offices handled over 6,000 individual cases, wrote about 250,000 letters. And we got back to everyone in 48 hours. And our offices were open in a week when we got started. That was my – and we opened in Binghamton and Utica and, of course, D.C. I can't really speak to what she's doing in that regard because I don't know, and it's fairly well not my business. But we tried to do that thing which I think has been most valuable for me in the 6 years I did this, and that is help people one at a time and be very responsive. I made hundreds and hundreds of phone calls, and I made a point twice a year to call all the people in all the towns, villages, mayors individually and thank them for their help, offer our help, and just kind of get a lay of the land.
Now, in recent weeks, there's been a lot of attention paid to members of Congress holding or not holding town hall meetings in their districts, and there have been different views put forward about what's behind the calls for more meetings. What do you make of this?
I think it's wrong not to hold meetings. We had 74 of them in my time, roughly. I think that's the number. And it's important. And I think that I went on one CODEL, went a couple places with the Aspen Institute. But I never went on a CODEL that didn't specifically relate to my community and what the committees I was on.
And just explain, you say CODEL. Tell
our congressional trip.
Okay.
They're supposed to be fact-finding trips.
Right.
They are, but they're also a lot of fun for a lot of people, as you can imagine. An opportunity to travel around the world basically on the government's nickel or people's nickel. I think that in my case, we wrote, by the time we'd left, 974 vote explanations. I was the only guy in the House and Senate who did that. And we'd stay up late nights doing it. The staff did most of the work, to tell you the truth. But I read them, and we went through them together. This job is about transparency. At least I thought my job was. And to deny people the opportunity to criticize you or hear from you the way you voted for them, you know, got to remember every minute of every day. The title's representative. Mm-hmm. You're a big shot and you're a congressman when you're down there, maybe. But the reality is, it's about representing people. And if you're going to go there and be an ideologue and represent, you know, the 20 or 30,000 people that show up in a primary to get you elected, you're not a good representative. What you are is a tone-deaf person who went down to Washington and joined the orthodoxy. And as a practical matter, you look at the Freedom Caucus, and I know these guys, their reasoning for holding up the health care bill is that they made a promise that they would repeal Obamacare. Well, that isn't going to go anywhere. If they get what they want, it'll never get out of Senate. My point is, the nature of this job requires you to lead, not take polls and parrot back what you just heard from the people that are most likely to support you if you agree with them. So what we tried to do, and I have an unusual record, I always supported women's health care. I have the best record with Planned Parenthood, and I signed amicus briefs each time I could for the LGBT community, which I supported 100%. I believe global climate change is an issue that we should be discussing, not burying our heads in the sand, all of that. And that required me to come back to a conservative Republican Party and explain to them why I did that. And they, a lot of times, were not happy. But that's the job. That's the definition of leading. Any fool can take a poll and tell somebody what they just told them they wanted to hear. And that's altogether too much of what happens.
Now, in Congress, you were on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. Mm-hmm. So I was interested to know what you think about President Trump's plans for infrastructure investment.
Well, it's important. We're way behind. It's by any measure you take, there are at least $1 trillion that could be invested right away, and by many estimates, much more. The difficulty hasn't changed, though. There are a number of members. You remember that I'm one of the only guys there. I never signed any pledges. So the Grover Norquist pledge that you've heard about, and I like Grover. He's quite a character. I never signed any of those, not a one, because my vote belongs to these people, and I'm not going to give it up to some group. But a lot of these guys have, and they kind of walked back away from that now. But if you remember, they couldn't even get a gas tax passed, and that's how we pay for the Highway Trust Fund, is through diesel, gas, and excise taxes on interstate transportation items. And time and time again, I work to try to find a way to fund transportation, and I signed a lot of bills that were not popular, whether it be two or three people, to try to find a way to pay for that. Upstate alone has over 6,000 deficient bridges. So I don't see that dynamic changing. Hmm. If everything has to intersect the debt and the deficit, and we have severe problems, you know, this $20 trillion debt that we're talking about and growing, and I get that. But if you're not invested in your future, if you're not willing to invest in education and infrastructure, you don't become more competitive. You don't become able to grow better. What you really do is you put yourself further behind. So we need to invest in infrastructure. We need to find a way to pay for it. And what you see is 26 states have found ways to raise their taxes to pay for infrastructure. The federal government can't, because it's demagoguing the issue. And you have a group of people, and it's a numbers game down there, that know that at any given moment, the leader of that group, the Freedom Caucus, is effectively the speaker, because they vote en masse. If 80% of agree with them to vote, they all vote the same. So the speaker is helpless, regardless of what he wants to do.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with former Congressman Richard Hanna. He represented New York's 22nd Congressional District. I wanted to ask you a question about Paul Ryan, actually, the speaker on paper, I guess, going back to what you just said before about the Freedom Caucus. But from the outside, it does look like Paul Ryan really does have his hands full politically between the White House, the right wing of his party, and then everyone else. And so as a former insider there, can you give me some insight into what he's trying to deal with?
Paul's a decent guy. He's very, very conservative. He would love to shut down the choice issue for women in Planned Parenthood. I'm certain of that, at least in terms of their ability to provide abortion coverage. So that's where he is. But he also has a job of governing. And he's a guy who voted not to raise the debt limit. I mean, when he was – it's a lot different job being speaker than it is being a rank-and-file member. I can remember voting yes and having people walk up to me and say, I'm glad you voted yes so I could vote no. which drove me crazy. But, you know, it was an embarrassing thing to hear from someone's mouth. But Paul's a decent guy. He's trying. And they're wise enough to know that Obamacare, with they've made claims that people should be covered for pre-existing conditions and that they like the idea of covering people until they're 26 on their parents' insurance and that 20 million people are on Obamacare. Paul's practical enough and reasonable enough to know that if you try to take all that away, and many of the people who supported Donald Trump are finding out now that that's their benefit. You just can't do that. But then you have the orthodoxy of the far right, and that's an interesting term because it's a function. It is a fungible thing being to the right. From where I sat, there were almost nobody. There was almost no one to the center, and center has moved to the right. You know, so he's a practical guy, and he's got to send something to the Senate that they can not turn a they won't necessarily and quickly turn a jaundiced eye to. And but the Freedom Caucus, it's not about facts. It's about orthodoxy and ideology. And their promise to their base that they were going to shut down Obamacare and they're not going to take anything less. So and, of course, they have this devolution to the states notion, which pits states against states. Right. It's particularly bad for New York. And I give John Katko credit for voting against it. I mean, if the hanging your hat on changing the nature of Medicaid for New York in this for 4 years, forcing the state to pick up the bill doesn't change the bill. And New York has one of the most generous Medicaid systems in the country. And but you've got to realize in 4 years, that money gets cut in half. So you put New York in a terrible hole. So I could not have supported that. And the fact that it would defund Planned Parenthood, I found particularly objectionable. And I want to say something about that. If you look at the numbers, what you see in that regard is blue states that provide contraception in that whole gambit of benefits to women, including abortion coverage. Those are the places where abortion has never been lower. And everybody wants it to be zero. Nobody's in favor of it. But we realize that women have a right to choose.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with former Congressman Richard Hanna. He represented New York's 22nd District. The last time we talked on this program, your name was getting thrown around a bit as a possible candidate for governor here in New York State. Where is that idea standing with you at present?
Not likely something I'm going to do. I think that Trump's popularity in this state is so low, and around the country, if you watch the numbers, that I don't see that changing. My point is that I think there's going to be a backlash at the Republican Party, and I think that the dynamics of New York State have not changed. Downstate controls whoever has statewide office, and the Republican Party has never quite figured out. They want to keep putting up people like Carl Paladino. And whether you like him or not, and I don't, for all host of reasons, but or Wendy Long, that you can't win a statewide election. And they're wasting their time. The reason they wanted me to run is I have a good record on the Second Amendment. I have a great fiscal record. And yet I have a good record on social issues that would appeal downstate. And I have a good environmental record. So they look at that and they say, there's a guy that ought to run. But you heard what Ed Cox said. It was a decent guy. Ed said he'll never get the nomination. And you know, frankly, Ed wouldn't help me, and I wouldn't ask. So I accept that on the face of it, that being a plausible candidate doesn't make you necessarily somebody they'll support.
Now, regardless of that political plan or not non-plan, what do you think is the one biggest, if you could identify one, one biggest problem or challenge for the state of New York?
Well, New York's making itself a difficult place to succeed. The bureaucracy, the taxes, it's a well – if you look at the list of states that are competitive year in and year out, put on by – out by a number of groups, but takes CNBC, we're dead last in a whole host of things. What we're great at is education, but we're not great at keeping people in the community once they get educated here. You can't continually – and I think the way we fund Medicaid is wrong in this state. In my community, Oneida County, I think it's 70-80% of the budget goes for Medicaid. It's unsustainable. And I think just in general, the state has sent the message that it's not business friendly. I was in business for 30 years. And, you know, it's one thing to make money, and I always did okay. But it's quite another matter to pile burden on after burden and bureaucracy after bureaucracy. You had enough money in your life, you quit. I loved what I did. I didn't want to really get out of it, but it became not worth it. You can discourage entrepreneurship. You can take the heart out of people. And I think that New York is sending the message that there are 49 other states, and almost all of them are a better place to set up your life.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Richard Hanna, a former member of Congress. You mentioned just a little bit earlier.
Incidentally, I love it here myself. I really do.
Just to be clear.
Yeah, I don't want to move.
You're still here. You mentioned a little bit earlier that you see a backlash coming for Republicans, part of your calculation about governor. And a lot of political analysts, I think, agree with you. Certainly anyone with a late-night TV show agrees with you. But let me pose this to you and see what your reaction is. What if the economy picks up nationally? What if the Republican Party can deliver a tax cut nationally and we start getting better jobs reports and so on? Do you think that might outweigh the other negative things currently dragging them down?
No, I think the daily chaos you see out of Washington and the shoot-from-the-hip policy that you see on a daily basis. And just, go look at the L.A. Times, what they've been writing about President Trump. You know, I came out against him strongly in August and always hoped that I was completely wrong. And I haven't seen that yet. And I don't see anything on the horizon that suggests otherwise. I think that even if those things happen, the severity of the Republican agenda on a whole host of issues that, frankly, they were never on. You know, don't forget, Title X was Richard Nixon. The Civil Rights Bill was signed with Republican help, Lyndon Johnson, and Teddy Roosevelt, a great environmentalist. I mean, there are, and Medicare Part D was passed with Paul Ryan's vote, helped, I think, was that 1999, 2000? Something
George
like that,
Bush, yeah.
Yeah, and all of that. And the party has just adopted this, and they're true believers, incidentally. I think that a lot of the people that have been elected there in the year that I went in, the 95 or so new members, 80 to 95, they are the hard right. And they are entrenched, and they have a constituency that supports them. And gerrymandering has made it so that general elections are all but perfunctory in terms of our opportunity to pick somebody we like, who might be, like for this district, in my district, someone more moderate. It's a hard thing and line to toe. These guys want to get reelected, men and women, and they want to go back to their jobs in D.C. and be members of Congress, and they know how to do it. And the money goes to them, and the gerrymandering brings the keeps them in seats that once they get the nomination, they're fine from the right or the left. So what happens is they know that their most dangerous point is if there's someone to the right of them, if they're Republican, or someone to the left of them. And that's not how you build a pluralistic, tolerant, and frankly, happy society. And when you look at the aging of our society and the demographics, 10,000 people a day signing up for Medicare and Social Security, those are our two biggest problems, right, in terms of how we control our debt. And those are the one thing, those are the two things nobody ever talks about. Mm-hmm. They dance around the edges. You look at the president's budget, it cuts NPR, it cuts Meals on Wheels. I mean, it eliminates Planned Parenthood. You pick something. The Great Lakes, they don't want to support quality water in the Great Lakes. The list is endless, all to pay for $54 billion more in defense. I don't think that goes anywhere in the Senate, but just that message alone ought to scare everybody.
We've just got a couple minutes left, but I wanted to tap your thoughts on two more local issues, get your take on them. First, where are you on what we should do with I-81?
I'm not as familiar with that as my buddy John Katko, but I think the off-ramp that you want up right up the road here, I think you ought to get that, and I don't know what's holding that up. And if you have something specific, but I have to tell you, I'm not up to speed on that.
Well, let me try this one then. The Consensus Commission on Local Government Modernization has issued its final set of recommendations, and the one big one was this idea, and again, it's a little bit out of your district, but one metropolitan government for Onondaga County. Mm-hmm. Do you have any views on those kinds of ideas?
I think they're good. I think that if you were going to design a community like upstate New York, it would never look like it does. If you sat down and said, how do we want to make something that's efficient? Where I live, between Herkimer and Madison, I think there are 27 police departments. And, you know, busing between communities with schools overlapping. I mean, there's no end to the opportunities for consolidation, but there's a lot of parochialism that causes people to like what they have, and change is always hard to bring about. But I mean, I can honestly say I don't think anybody would design what you have. And if you look at other states like Florida, they have countywide government. They don't do what we do. And I think that makes a lot of sense.
Now, with just a few seconds left, and I'm going to force you into just picking one thing to say. Let's say you could have a do-over. You could have those 6 years over in Congress. What would be the one thing you'd want to do differently?
You know, being in Congress is like, you ever listen to Leonard Cohen? It's kind of depressing, but interesting at the same time. That's the way Congress was. It's like, I don't regret it, but I've always been busy, always worked day in and day out, and I love that. And I had being away from your family and feeling as though you're part of a group, a club that you would not join if you knew what it was going to be like. I regret that middle pragmatic core that accepted compromise because there was a drive to move forward and understood that tolerance and pluralism and is where the solutions are. But the severity of the ideology on both sides that kind of check the box mentality has made it so that people who want to create solutions out of compromise, there's just not enough of them. And so you wind up with the extremes. And it's the same on the Democratic side, incidentally.
That was Richard Hanna. Richard, thanks so much for talking with me.
Oh, it's always fun. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.